Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Masters in Business is brought to you by ProperCloth, the leader in men's custom shirts. With proprietary smart size technology and top-rated customer service, ordering a custom shirt has never been easier. Visit ProperCloth.com to order your first custom shirt today.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, we have a repeat visit from one of our most popular guests. His name is Professor Scott Galloway. He teaches digital brands and marketing at the NYU Stern School of Business. I first kind of came into contact with Professor Galloway through a famous video he did called The Four Horsemen of the Internet about Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple, and he is one of those people who is just a fascinating study, a person who does deep dives into the things we kind of take for granted about technology, about marketing, about how we interact with some of our favorite products. And he does it in a way that's not purely academic. He formed a number of companies, L2, Red Envelope, Profit, and sold them for tons of money. And so he's more than just a theoretician. He's an actual practitioner. He's always fascinating. We always have a delightful conversation every time I have him in the studio. He has a new book coming out next year, so we'll have an excuse to bring him back when that comes out. In the meantime, with no further ado, my conversation with Scott Galloway.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is Professor Scott Galloway. He hails to us from NYU Stern School of Business. He is the author of the Digital IQ Index, a global ranking of prestige digital competence. He has been ranked one of the world's 50 best business school professors. He founded several companies, Red Envelope, Profit, L2. He has also been recognized by the World's Economic Forum as one of the global leaders of tomorrow. Professor Scott Galloway, welcome back to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry. Good to see you.
What brought you to my attention a few years ago was a video that you had done. It was a conference appearance about the four horsemen, mm-hmm. and they were Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. So why don't we start with those?
Sure.
Let's talk about Google. In a recent L2 video you did, and you also speak every year at the Digital Brands Conference, DLD, I think it is.
DLD in Munich, great conference.
You talked about Google lowered its price 11%, mm-hmm. and yet it increased its total ad revenue 20%. Mm-hmm. They seem to really be dominating online advertising.
Can you imagine how difficult all this, whether you're competing with them, your Clear Channel Outdoor, the New York Times, your Hearst, and you have a competitor that's able to increase its revenues 23% and lower its prices 11%. And initially, the analysts thought that was a sign of weakness because their cost per click was going down. But effectively, Google every year gets more and more competitive. It's like, how do you know if an industry is ripe to be disrupted? They raise their prices faster than inflation with no underlying increase in innovation. You could argue that media or television is incredibly ripe to be disrupted, mm-hmm. increase the prices much faster than inflation while viewership has gone down. Whereas Google is probably the least disruptable business right now in media because every year it gets substantially better and they keep lowering their prices.
So the other leader in digital advertising is Facebook.
Yep.
Are they ever going to be able to give Google a run for their money?
Oh, they already are. I mean, between the two of them, and it really is a duopoly. If you look at all of digital marketing, Facebook and Google accounted for 103% of the growth. Now, what does that mean? It means that if you aren't Facebook or Google and you're in digital marketing, officially the industry is in structural decline. So if you work for any one of these ad tech platforms, search engine optimization, an agency doing media planning online, your business, like newspapers and magazines, is in decline.
So let's talk a little bit about Facebook. You said their pivot to mobile was one of the greatest shifts of a large corporation in history.
Yeah, arguably the most agile company in the world. 3 years ago, 0% of the revenue from mobile. Mark Zuckerberg said he did not believe in kind of the app economy, thought it was all going to be about browsers. And he was wrong and pivoted and turned the fire hose of great management, great engineering talent. And now I think about 83, 85% of the revenue comes from mobile. It's hard to imagine a pivot. We all saw mobile coming, but Yahoo wasn't able to get to 80%. The New York Times wasn't. This is the most impressive agile pivot, I think, in the history of business.
Now, you've also previously called them one of the greatest bait and switch setups of all time. Why is that?
So the general promise from Facebook was invest in your Facebook page, Nike, and you're going to have this incredible asset. You're going to have a captive marketing or a captive asset, which will be people who have raised their hand and said, I have an affinity for Nike, and then you'll be able to communicate directly to them, that you'll have an asset. In order to build this asset, you had to advertise. And Nike and other firms spent millions of dollars advertising to build their fan community. And it was nice because it had this vanity metric of how many fans you had. It became a symbol of whether a company got it or not based on how many fans you had on Facebook. And then once kind of that hundreds of millions of spending to build these communities was sort of done, Facebook turned around and said, just kidding. If you want to reach these people, you've got to advertise. And organic reach, that is the percentage of Nike's messages that reach their end fans, went from 100% down to 8, 5, or 3. It's tantamount to you building a house, putting the finishing touches on it, putting the lock on the door, and then the county shows up and says, just kidding, you don't own the house, we do. I think this was one of the greatest bait and switches in corporate history.
What did that do to the trust factor of corporations wanting to advertise on Facebook?
I think it was temporary because there's so much momentum. It's such an outstanding product. They have such power that, and quite frankly, also I think they've done such a great job managing their image because I think their management team is likable, which I think is incredibly important. People have largely overlooked it. If you want to figure out a way to like somebody, you figure it out.
What about ad fatigue is something that certainly is an issue these days?
Yeah, so the engagement levels, the percentage of people interacting with a piece of content on Facebook, are 17% of their posts are sponsored, meaning they're basically advertising.
And inserted right into your
wall. Right into your feed. One out of six pieces of content is someone's paying to get in front of you. Interruption advertising, no different than television. However, the interaction or the percentage of people who are liking, sharing, or commenting on that content has declined 20% in the last 9 months. So you are seeing what you would call ad fatigue low. Now, having said that, they have other properties and tons of different ways to monetize, but the core platform does seem to be experiencing ad fatigue.
And what about Facebook Live and Facebook Native Stories? Is that going anywhere, or what's the outlook on that?
So I personally believe the biggest innovation or the thing to watch right now is from one of their properties, Instagram, specifically Instagram Stories, because it is squarely going after Snapchat. And what's interesting, and I think the most interesting piece of data in the world of media right now, is to look at Snapchat's user growth and daily active users once Instagram launched Stories, a direct competitor. And what you've seen is Snapchat's growth has decelerated dramatically since Instagram launched Stories. So people think Snapchat is the Facebook of video. My thesis is that, in fact, Facebook is the Facebook of video and is coming after Snapchat. And it's fun to speculate, but I think Snapchat goes public, goes crazy on first day of trading because people haven't had access to a unicorn in a while. But I think it's going to be ground zero for ringing the bell at the top and be one of the greatest. I think we're setting ourselves up for something that might be the spark that torches the market with Snapchat.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Professor Scott Galloway of NYU Stern School of Business. He is an expert on internet technology, digital marketing, branding. And let's talk about one of the biggest companies in that space, Amazon. Last time you were here, we talked about why you thought the stock was overvalued and wouldn't go anywhere. You very famously issued a mea culpa online, said pretty much that marked the start of the next major leg up. What do we think of Amazon today?
So first off, I was 110% wrong on that. My initial thought was that the future is about multi-channel retail. Their fulfillment costs were escalating, and I thought that they were going to need to buy a multi-channel retailer.
Their delivery costs also has gone up in billions.
Yeah, it continues to, but now people see it as an asset, not a liability, and there's some merit to that. So at the time, I thought, okay, Apple would be the first $1 trillion company because somebody's going to get there. And what Apple's pulled off is exceptional, lowest price or low cost provider because of their supply chain power, but at the same time, the margins. Premium price products. So the volumes of Toyota with the margins of Ferrari, which makes for the most profitable company in history. Now, Amazon is the most disruptive company in the largest economy in the world. And if you look at the moats and the number of distinct businesses they would have that would probably be greater than $100 billion businesses on their own, they have the most. Apple's right up there, but now you have AWS, you have the core platform itself. It looks as if Amazon Prime and their media properties are turning into a juggernaut. I also believe the real growth business for them is that they're going into the business of selling picks as opposed to mining for gold, leasing planes, leasing tractor trailers. They're going after FedEx and UPS. $120 billion in market cap between DHL, FedEx, and UPS. And I think Amazon's decided they want most or all of it. I think most of us are who have e-commerce companies or brands are going to start using Amazon not only as a platform with the Amazon Marketplace, but using Amazon to deliver the last mile.
When you say AWS, you're referring to the cloud services that they offer.
100%.
I have a funny Amazon story. So I have a treadmill in my basement, and I have a flat panel TV, which have plummeted in price. Smart TVs, 55 inches, $400. I want to hang it. It sits there for a week with a drill for a month. Finally, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go back to the store I got it and have them hang it. They want more to hang the TV than the TV cost. And so I start looking on, let me find a place to look online. And I never even heard of Amazon Home Services. What is this? It's $69. One of the local stores wanted $450 to hang it. So I set up an appointment. The guy shows up. He hangs the TV for $69. I say, who else do you work with? And he reels off everybody. And I said, those are all wildly disparate price points. He goes, I get paid the same. It's the same drill. It's the same stuff. He goes, I've done three houses on a block where the costs are $69, $300, and $500. It's me. And then I start looking at the Amazon services that are offered. It's pretty much everything for your house. Where are they going to stop growing? Where do they draw the line? Or are they just completely, no market is too far for them?
I think when it comes to your low consideration purchases or your high consideration purchases that you don't enjoy, auto insurance, I think Amazon wants all of it. And what's interesting about Amazon, and one of the incredibly impressive things, the hardware innovation of 2016, even though it came out earlier than that, was the Echo. And if you have, do you have an Amazon Echo?
I do not.
So you get one of these things and it literally kind of blows your mind because you get a glimpse into what the future of retail and commerce might be. You put these things around your house, and literally at this volume, you know, you say Alexa, and it says yes, and you make a request, order an Uber, add Tide to my shopping basket. And when you start thinking about the frictionless nature of voice, you start thinking about Amazon's purchase history, the fact they have your credit card, one-click ordering, the reputation for value they have, the fact that they have a warehouse within 20 miles of 45% of the population, which is it's misleading because it's really 80% of the disposable income of the U.S. You have what I believe, and by the way, I don't know this. I don't work directly with Amazon. I believe where they're headed is something called Prime Squared or something similar to that. They'll announce a test area and they'll say, Barry, we know a lot about you. We're going to install these Echoes all over your house. Whenever you need anything, you calibrate up or down. We send you two boxes three times a week, one's with your stuff. The second you put stuff that you don't want back in the box, and we calibrate some more. And over time, we're going to take your entire retail ecosystem off the table from everybody else. And 80-90% of everything you order in your life that you don't enjoy ordering, you enjoy looking for cars. You want to go buy that BMW Z8. Your wife wants to buy that pair of Christian Louboutins. The other 95% of stuff you don't enjoy buying, Amazon is going to do for you automatically. They're going to do a test, most likely in a college town. They're going to announce they're going to take Prime from $1,300 a year to $8,000. The stock's going to become
per user.
Per household, the stock's going to become anti-gravity and go to $1 trillion. I think Amazon's the first one to get
So that. Here's why I haven't gotten the Echo. I have three experiences with voice recognition software. One is Google Voice, which is sort of hilarious, garbled thing. The second is Siri, which if you read the damn you autocorrect, is one of the funniest collection of typos, and we've all experienced really embarrassing things because of the way that works. So I looked at Echo as just another mediocre voice recognition product. You're telling me that's not true.
Well, they're trying to, Google and Apple are trying to, it's probably more ambitious, they're trying to do it more around utility, find me an Applebee's, or how do I get here, or call Barry. Alexa is, all right, get me information. You use it for a search engine. My son does it to test his geography skills and capital skills. But they're positioning it around commerce. And when you think about the easiest place to make decisions around commerce seamlessly, saying, Alexa, you know, barbecue 8 people Friday night, and it immediately goes into your purchase history, your preferences, your brand preferences, and puts together a package of additional ribs, imported beer, but IPA because that's what you like, and then a selection of stuff, and it begins to calibrate and can get it there within 2 hours because of their fulfillment network. You at some point just sort of throw in the towel and realize that Amazon is the only retailer that matters, is the only retailer I need in my life. And as we get busier and busier and suffer from more and more time poverty, the opportunity for voice, artificial intelligence, and the incredible investment they've made in fulfillment infrastructure will result in a value proposition where you might decide all the shopping and decisions I make around commerce in my life, except for the ones I love, I am just going to outsource to Amazon. You also have an Amazon, to a certain extent, the game is sort of already over. I play Texas Hold'em poker every few weeks with a bunch of guys. And at some point when one player has most of the chips, he or she's already won because they can muscle everybody out by just going all in until they finally win. Amazon basically is at that point. Their access to capital is probably, they've had access to cheaper capital for longer than probably any company in modern history. And as a result, they're basically muscling everybody out.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Scott Galloway. He is a professor of brand strategy and digital marketing at the NYU Stern School of Business. He is the author of the Digital IQ Index, named one of the world's 50 best business school professors. He's founded and sold a number of companies. We were talking about Amazon before and how they had a clearly defined mission. What is the problem with Apple's mission description?
Well, there isn't one. The others have very succinct and compelling missions that are the investment community understands and demands. Apple does not. It's not entirely clear what Apple is trying to achieve long term. So as a result, Apple has become a what have you done for me lately in the investment market. It's evaluated in the context of every product release. And if that product doesn't revolutionize the world, which many have, the stock gets taken down. So you have the other horsemen, Facebook, Amazon, and Google, trading at anywhere between kind of 20 and 60 times EBITDA, and you have Apple trading at 7 to 10. So you could argue Apple could be the first trillion-dollar company if it just got a story, if it just said, this is what we're about and where we're headed.
So I'm a Mac head dating back to my 1989 classic, Mac classic, and to me the Apple story was always, it just works. When the competition was Compaq, HP, IBM, Dell, they didn't just work. Windows back in those days was a nightmare.
Yep.
And we've seen a variety of innovations, starting with the iPod. There was nothing new about that technology. It was all off-the-shelf stuff. They put it together in a way nobody else did. iPod, iPhone, iPad, iWatch. Have they run out of innovation, or are we still milking the last five major products?
So that seems to be the key question. A lot of people would say, are AirPods really the design breakthrough, the wireless earpieces? Is the Apple Watch really kind of the legacy of the most creative industrial engineers in the world? So a lot of people would say that I would say that Apple is theoretically suffering from low T. It appears as if it's lost its mojo. Having said that, it has such an incredible brand. It has so much credibility around anything, any item. And quite frankly, it still trades
cheap.
You're in this business, right? It doesn't feel expensive. It feels like, basically, Barry, it's up 20% in the last couple months because people just, with no real catalyst.
So here's the crazy data point we pulled together when we were doing research for this show. You take the Apple cash hoard, just the cash dollars it has. There are only 13 companies in the S&P 500 that their entire worth is greater than Apple's cash hoard. That's astonishing data point, which raises the question what they should do with all that cash. But let's come back to that. I want to talk about the Apple Watch, which people have called kind of a failure. But when you look at the numbers and you look at what they've done to the Swiss watchmaking group, let's talk about that. Is the Apple Watch a success or a failure? I notice you're not wearing one.
I'm not. So the
nor am
first
I.
Off, and this goes back to what Apple strength is. This thing on my wrist, I haven't wound it in 5 years.
Right.
If I'm honest with myself, it's my attempt to signal masculinity and success to the opposite sex. I think men who wear expensive watches are basically trying to communicate to women, if you mate with me, your kids are more likely to survive than if they mate with someone wearing a Swatch watch.
So this is a Darwinian.
These are feathers. Period.
Full stop.
Feathers. They have very little utility. And Apple's genius has been figuring out a way to make a tech item feathers. Apple has effectively decided they want out of the technology hardware business, which trades at a multiple of EBITDA, and they want to be in the luxury business, which trades at a multiple of revenues. It's a far superior business. The only way they can sustain their margins is by having what we would refer to as self-expressive benefit. Apple has become the ultimate display of wealth. If you do a heat map by operating system, Android versus iOS, it is a heat map of wealth. Manhattan lights up iOS. You go into the suburbs, it's Android. The new feather. If you have an iPhone, it means you're more likely to be successful, educated, and have a random sexual experience. This is the reason that they have the highest margins in that industry. And the iPhone is the first technology product whose margins have not eroded as the product has matured because they've figured out it's a luxury brand. It's not a technology brand.
So one of your presentations, you talk about the mobile phone as the defining technology of our age.
Sure.
Apple captures 92% of the profits. Samsung captures 13 to 14%, which includes some overlap because they're a big supplier to Apple. The rest of the industry are negative.
Fights and losses. And Apple versus Samsung is illuminating because they've taken different approaches. Samsung invests 2 to 3 times the amount of their top line revenues in traditional advertising and digital marketing. So what does Apple do with all that excess capital? They have opened stores. Most people would say that Apple's genius has been the iPhone. I would argue that Apple's genius move over the last 13 years was building 450 temples to the brand in 18 markets called stores.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Scott Galloway. He is a professor of digital brands and marketing at NYU Stern School of Business. Last time we had you on, you caused a little bit of controversy with your infamous letter about millennials. We talked about it. So let me ask you the question. Do you love or hate millennials?
Oh, gosh. It's easy to hate millennials, but I would, for all the complaints the business owners put forward, at the end of the day, there's two sides of the transaction. And the reason why we put up with millennials, and they are more expectant, more difficult to manage, is because they're more talented than we were at their age. The access to technology, the increase in education, more kids are graduating from college, is exceptional. They are the most talented generation. There's a price to it, though. They want to talk about their careers. When I got my first job at Morgan Stanley out of UCLA, we had a career talk once a year in the form of a bonus, and it lasted about 15 minutes, and that was about it. It was so the notion of going into my boss's office and saying, I want to have a career talk you know, 6 weeks after I started. I mean, I can't even fathom the response I would have received. But
they throw you out. It would have been the response.
At L2, the most inspiring people, I think the thing I enjoy the most is the kids. We have some 22 to 28 year olds, and I would describe them, and this is a sexist statement, mostly women. 70% of high school valedictorians are now women, mostly athletes, the competitive grit in their background. And it's kind of passe to say that. I don't necessarily think it's a good thing, but went to outstanding universities. They have real academic, strong academic training from the best institutions. These people are, you know, they feel as if they could be the junior senator from Pennsylvania, these 26-year-olds. They are so inspiring. At the same time, they're used to feedback. They're used to recognition. They're used to clarity around roles and compensation. And these are all things, when you think about it, we demand as we get older and we have more currency in the marketplace. They've just figured it out earlier. The ones that aren't good, it seems to have, you know, they don't, maybe don't have the skills, but they seem to hold on to some of the negative attributes. And those are the ones that get all the press. But on the whole, millennials have built L2 for us, and I'm a fan.
The fascinating thing is for guys who are our age, and we're not that far apart in years, technology is something we've learned. For them, it's a native language. It's something they grew up with as infants. You start playing with an iPad in
the
crib. Right.
They just get it.
It's just there. All right, so let's talk about some of the other things that, for those of you listening, you should definitely check out Professor Galloway's videos on YouTube. They're incredibly informative and often entertaining. A line you said not too long ago I thought was fascinating is, advertising is a tax on the poor. Explain. Mm-hmm.
So effectively, technology is allowing us to opt out of advertising. I love Modern Family. I don't know if you watch Modern Family.
Sure, great.
But I now download it from iTunes for $2.99, even though I could download it as quickly from ABC.com, because ABC.com makes me watch 9 minutes of commercials. Mm-hmm. I think just as we become numb to mass shootings in the U.S., we become numb to advertising. I think advertising is so ubiquitous, but at the same time, so terrible. We were talking about age. I've worked out my whole life. I'm at an age where I can no longer do impact sports, so I'm swimming. Mm-hmm. And swimming is typically the first few minutes are shock to your system, no fun, I'm not going to be able to do this very long. Then you get into a rhythm and you get going. I think great storytelling on television is like that, where it takes a while, sometimes two or three episodes into the season to really get into it. I find I'm just finally starting to get into season six, I think it is, of Homeland. I equate advertising to your first 11 minutes in the pool, and then someone takes an enormous dump in the pool. And it's shocking. It's out of character. It's disturbing. You have to stop swimming and listen to and clean it up for 2 minutes. That is advertising. So technology is allowing us to opt out. You're going to have the NewYorkTimes.com without advertising soon. And the reality is they don't get that much money from you. It is such a game of scale. The New York Times only gets $2.70 a year for littering that gorgeous journalism with all sorts of ads. Modern Family only gets 55 cents an episode per viewer. Business Insider, Barry, only gets 65 cents a year for making you endure all those irrelevant, obsolete, and obtuse ads that slow the load time. Advertising is becoming a tax the poor and the technologically illiterate pay.
So what does that mean to companies like Google and Facebook if we're just becoming oblivious to these ads?
Well, Google, you're sort of asking for the ads. I mean, Google has the most relevant ads in the world because you're the one saying, I'm interested in auto insurance. And then it says, all right, these are the organic listings by auto insurance companies or articles on auto insurance that have credibility or that people search for. But along the right rail, we're going to let auto insurance companies advertise. So it's almost like you're asking for the advertising. Mm-hmm. Facebook is still interruption advertising. I think they're going to have to get into different businesses because I do think there is at some point every media company is going to have to offer a non-ad supported product. But these companies, their content is so compelling. I mean, probably most successful media company in the world, Google, because you've wanted the ads. I would say the second most successful media company in the world the last 30 years, Bloomberg. And guess what? It's not ad-supported. It's subscription-based.
Right.
A survivability index for all media companies globally is very easy. Take the percentage of the revenues they're getting from subscription versus advertising. The part of this house that makes a ton of money, it's 100%
subscription.
Payment. Subscription.
Right. So the more advertising, the weaker the longevity.
You'd rather
forecast.
Be HBO than ESPN right now.
You referenced not too long ago The Winner Take All Society, which was a book in the mid-90s by Robert Frank, mm-hmm. a prior guest on Masters in Business, mm-hmm. and essentially says no matter where you can look in sports, you can look at actors, you can look at music, you can look in companies, there's a winner in a given space, and then everybody else comes in third. What does this mean for technology? What does this mean for content?
It's dramatic, and you do this for a living. There are, of the S&P 500, there are only 13 companies that beat the index 5 years in a row.
That's unbelievable.
So it's never been better to be a winner. And unfortunately, we have this lottery economy because those companies get a tremendous amount of heat in advertising and publicity. We assume there are more winners than there are. Mm-hmm. Now the winners are enormous. You hit it big. It's never been a better time to be remarkable. Access to global markets, the ability to scale your intellectual property, the ability for good products and good people to get it out there on whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook or just consumer discovery. There's never been a worse time to be good. It's the way I think of it is when I got out of business school, we all made $85,000 and some made 70 and some made 100. But now in my class, I teach two classes, 120 kids. I can tell you there's going to be a billionaire in one of my classes tonight.
One of the things you said was that it's never been easier. I'm going to just keep throwing your own quotes
sure.
at you. It's never been easier to be a billionaire in this society, and it's never been harder to become a millionaire.
The compact is breaking down. You go to undergrad, you study hard, you get a good job, you go to graduate school, you're a good citizen, you work hard, you get the credentials. You get a partner that's also a contributor to you economically. It's not unreasonable to think you could save $1 million over mm-hmm. 20, 30, 40 years and retire a millionaire. That's getting harder and harder to do. But at the same time, everyone has an outside shot at becoming part of something unbelievable and becoming a billionaire. The other kids in my class, I think there's going to be a decent non-zero percentage of my class that's going to end up getting unlucky, having some dents in their career background, which, by the way, they won't be able to gloss over because LinkedIn creates tremendous
away.
Transparency, and will be excluded from, quote-unquote, the information economy, and will end up living with their parents until they're 50 or 60. We are entering an economy where it's winner-take-all, and we don't have, we don't believe in income distribution. We like to, because there's some very well-advertised success stories. People would rather people play the lottery because
sure.
it statistically is bad for us. We know it's not good, but hey, baby, my numbers are going to win.
My wife teaches fashion illustration and design to high school students. And in the high school, they actually, when they're doing career counseling with these kids, warn them, anything you put on Facebook, anything you put on Instagram, anything you put on Twitter is part of your permanent record. And you are affecting your career chances 10, 20, 30 years down the road. This stuff never goes away.
It's a new credit score.
It's unbelievable. Let's talk, since I mentioned Twitter, let's talk about Twitter. Another quote of yours. A good board cannot save a bad company, but a bad board can ruin a good company. What's the problem with Twitter?
A negligent board. Unforgivable. The fact that they've decided that whatever it is, 2,000 employees, a great product should be subject or should be led by a part-time employee.
Meaning the CEO.
CEO. And I don't know him. He sounds like a product visionary. But to say that a company is complicated, an environment is competitive, where as many people, where they have as many investors, where they have as many people trying to make a living from the fortunes or misfortune of Twitter, to decide that a part-time CEO is the right guy, how do you say to the rest of the management team, by the way, almost all of whom have left, mm-hmm. this thing is like rats off a ship right now. How do you say to them, this guy at 25 hours a week is better than you at 50 hours a week.
And it's such a great platform,
and
too.
It's a fantastic product. You literally have negligence on behalf of the board to put up with this. It's part of our idolatry of innovators. A young guy who's very impressive shows up in a black turtleneck, and they think we've reincarnated Steve Jobs. And
he
they
did
take,
it with Pixar and Apple.
And it is very a very dangerous strategy to compare anyone to Steve Jobs.
That's right.
And assuming it's going to happen again. So we end up like in an abusive relationship. We end up taking abuse that we shouldn't. It's ridiculous. He's going to go down. He's going to go down as one of the worst CEOs in tech. And it's not his fault. It's his board's fault. Boards have a fiduciary responsibility. The board of Twitter is negligent.
We have been speaking with Professor Scott Galloway of NYU Stern. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out our podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things digital. We love your comment, feedback, and suggestions. Please write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Check out my daily column on bloombergview.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Hey guys, let me ask you a question. Do you have trouble finding dress shirts that fit? Well, thanks to Proper Cloth, ordering custom shirts has never been easier. At ProperCloth.com, you can literally order a high-quality, perfect-fitting custom shirt in less than 5 minutes. Create your custom size by answering just 10 simple questions. No need for measuring tape or trips to the tailor. Perfect fit is guaranteed. Remakes are completely free, and expert staff are standing by to help. For premium quality, perfect-fitting shirts, visit ProperCloth.com. Custom shirts made smarter. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Galloway. Thank you so much for being Scott. I don't know what the hell to call you.
Scott's good.
Scott's good. During the break, we were talking about what happened to comments in general, and I said, when I was writing Bailout Nation, I would put a post up online, do 500 to 700 words. People would give me comments, suggestions, ideas, sources. I was writing that in real time relative to the crisis. I mean, it was due August 30th, 2008. And then that weekend when it was due, all hell broke loose. And so it got extended till December 31st. But I'm writing it in real time. My readers are really my co-authors. They did a tremendous amount of work. You publish a ton, especially on YouTube. What's going on with some of the comments on YouTube? What is that like?
So 95 to 98% of them are really supportive, interesting dialogue. The comments, when they don't agree with you, are generally respectful. But that 2 or 3% can be pretty rattling. And everybody, I like to put up this persona that, oh, I don't care, I can take it, I don't care what other people think.
Thick skin.
Yeah, and it rattles me. When people really say these incredibly personal, and what's weird is some of them seem to research you and try and find something that's gonna upset you or even frighten you. So there's an element of it that's really disturbing. What's interesting, though, is that if you think about this notion of identity, and that is, Facebook forces you to say who you are
in real life,
some feature, and it's created, I think, a more civil platform. And even when you think about the power of identity around Uber, you wouldn't get in the back seat of a driver that hadn't been vetted. Seeing his or her face makes you feel more comfortable, and they wouldn't likely let a stranger get in the back seat that they couldn't track down with their credit card number or their identity. So this notion of identity as it relates to Facebook, Uber, and even Airbnb, I would argue that the identity technology is really what's made Airbnb a $25 or $30 billion company or value company, is a really powerful notion in the internet age. But I think it's good that people, that platforms decide to force people to say, this is who I am, and it creates a more civil environment because all of a sudden people turn very mean online.
Your colleague at NYU, Arun Sundarrajan, his book on the sharing economy goes over how originally, the eBay rating system 100% led to companies like Airbnb and Uber and everything
else. I should have referenced him. My whole song I just busted into around identity, I was IP theft from Professor Sundarrajan. I got it from Arun. So Arun's a friend, so I absolutely I ripped off his comments there.
I use NYU as a as my research bench. I think I've had six different professors from NYU. And if you add in Columbia, I think we're up to 10.
That's good to hear.
The academic intellectual capital in New York, with Wharton an hour that way and Yale an hour that way, is just, it's an astonishing amount of, we have to get you out to one of the dinners we have with various Nobel Prize people. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about relevant to the comment situation is, what does that have to do with Facebook, since they're making you identify who you are? Instead of having really vociferous comments, you end up with fake news that gets passed along repeatedly. That seems to be the Facebook equivalent of the angry egg on Twitter, or just the insane comment on YouTube.
Well, the scandal of, we talked about Echo being the product of 2016. The scandal of 2016, we just don't know it yet, was fake news. It's going to get bigger and bigger in terms of the damage we perceived or that has actually happened to society. 60% of our news is now digested and absorbed from social media. 80% of the news coming out of social media the week running up to the election was fake news.
Really?
And one of the issues I personally have with Google and Facebook is this notion that if you look at their vocabulary and words matter, they're trying to avoid the word media to describe their companies. Mm-hmm. They're saying they're platforms. And the analogy I would use, Barry, is that if McDonald's said, all right, 80% of the beef we're serving you is fake and giving you encephalitis, and as a result, you're making bad decisions.
Mad cow disease?
We're not responsible for it because we're not a fast food restaurant. We're a fast food platform. And I think these companies trying to absolve themselves of the responsibility and the damage they've done by calling themselves platforms and not media companies. By the way, they're media companies. They create content. They sell advertising against that content. Boom, you're a media company. But they need to do a quarter of the fact-checking and the resource investment that the New York Times and Bloomberg make in ensuring that what we are digesting is not fake and making us sick. This is the scandal of 2016, hugely damaging to our society.
There was just an article in the New York Times this weekend about, you know, there's all sorts of ransomware. Mm-hmm. Not so much where they're taking over your computer, but there are people who have figured out how to game Google's search algorithms. Mm-hmm. And so they dig up. You want to talk about digging up stuff. They dig up from people because it's public. We've moved all this stuff from the government sphere to the public sphere. Mugshots. Someone's arrested 40 years ago, 30 years ago for driving under the influence. That mugshot is there. It shows up in the first page of Google searches. And Google, and so it's not, it says it's there for information purposes. They will take the mugshot down for a fee.
Yeah.
And that sort of blackmail shouldn't be, Google has a responsibility for that.
Well, I do think of that as different because you can make a bomb threat with a phone and I don't think the phone company is liable. But when
the
Facebook,
search algorithm.
But I do think it's different. When Facebook is got 80% of the content flowing through its platform is fake news, they know
Is it that much? Is it 80%?
Supposedly the week leading up to the election, about 80% of the news coming out on the candidates was quote-unquote fake news because the respective parties turned up the volume. I think at that point when their media channels, their platform, have literally become totally toxic and totally misleading, I think they have a responsibility to make a statement. And what they've done so far is they're so remiss to alienate anyone on the far left or the far right, because as Michael Jordan said, Republicans buy shoes too. They assume everybody watches ads, so we don't care how crazy you are. We don't want to alienate anybody. And we want the entire market. We want everyone watching on our platform. And it's sort of enough is enough. They're going to have to come up with some standards, kick some people off, squelch some content, and they'll be accused of censorship. But they're going to have to acting the same way a lot of these media companies, including Bloomberg, Hearst, Condé Nast, there's going to have to be something resembling editorial standards.
You need to lose the 10% that's toxic. And otherwise, from a business perspective, they're putting the 90% at risk, the people they're monetizing. Once people come to realize, hey, this platform is a disaster, I think that's been Twitter's big mistake. And they're just now taking steps to not so much kick people off the platform. The latest thing I've been reading about is if you're identified as a troll or someone who is harassing people because they're gay or black or Jewish or what have you, or Muslim, they're basically not going to let you put names in tweets. So you'll be able to harass people without identifying them, and it's just lost in the breeze. No one will see it or hear it.
But and this is you know, this gets me into trouble, but effectively most of the leadership of these companies wrap themselves in a progressive blanket to a certain extent because A, I think they have personally those viewpoints, but also it's awfully convenient because as a whole, progressives are perceived as being really nice but weak, and conservatives are seen as being smart but mean. And if a smart but mean person was running the most powerful company in the world, Google, Facebook, Amazon, or Apple, regulators would step in early. So it's convenient for them to be seen as kind of nice and cuddly and granola. Uh-huh. But the reality is, I don't think you can really claim to be a progressive if the company that you have a lot of power of has become weaponized by the far right. So I see hypocrisy everywhere here. These companies, these individuals prostitute the progressive values in order to soften the image of their companies such that they avoid regulatory scrutiny. At the same time, they have allowed their companies to be weaponized by the far right. I find contradiction in it everywhere.
I've done a lot of work and a lot of writing on minimum wage, and mm-hmm. I've been talking about, we have this grand experiment going on in Seattle and San Francisco and other cities that have been aggressively raising their minimum wage. Google, what is the minimum wage for Seattle? And it comes up $20 an hour, which isn't true. That's in 5 years, it's $20 an hour. Mm-hmm. If you're this large, if you're mm-hmm. this, it's 14 or 12 mm-hmm. or 15, depending on which city you're talking about. And yet, you know, Google tries to do the first slot is the answer to your question, mm-hmm. as opposed to sources with the answer. Mm-hmm. And what's taken place is that it's actually shows up as $20 an hour, which is wrong. Today, the minimum wage in Seattle is $15 an hour. So people have figured out how to game Google mm-hmm. for ideological reasons. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, you can't organize the Earth's information if the information you're providing is inaccurate. So they need to get on top of that.
Well, that's the exact point. You're talking about the paid versus organic listings, and organic listings do have some sort of credibility or check. And again, someone has gamed that. And Google would rather not do anything, nor Facebook, to suppress anybody from any viewpoint around either giving them eyeballs or money. And they're going to have to step in and say, we have some standards. It'll cost them money. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, I think they'll be better off and we'll be
better off. The alternative is enough people coming around and saying, I can't trust Google anymore. By the way, the reason Google became Google is I can trust Google because of their crowdsourced algorithm. Their PageRank mm-hmm. worked better than everybody else. Once it becomes clear that too often that no longer works and you're getting a gamed answer that's inaccurate, mm-hmm. their business model, you know, they don't have a moat. Their moat is essentially they're better than everybody else.
Yeah.
Once that falls away, they're in trouble. So they should protect that like the crown jewels, and they don't.
I think you're absolutely right, Barry. I would argue that Google so far has more credibility than any objectively evaluated entity in the world. And we've talked about the last time I was there. I think Google is a modern man's god, that as we become more educated and wealthier, are the number of people who attend church or think of religion as playing a large part in their life decreases. Mm-hmm. But modern day anxieties around sickness, why do bad things happen, what happens after we die, those anxieties either stay flat or increase. So the decline in the belief or the ability to get comfort from religion in concert with increasing anxiety has created this void, and I think Google has filled that void. 1 out of 5 queries to Google have never been asked before in the history of mankind.
Really? That's
fascinating.
Think about
a friend, a rabbi, a priest, that 1 out of 20% of the questions they get have never been asked before because they have so much credibility. Google is a modern man's god. It used to be, look to the skies, pray, will my son be all right? Now it's Google query, symptoms and treatment of croup.
So now here's the problem with that, and this goes back to them mm-hmm. protecting the crown jewels. I've had doctors, my favorite quote from a friend who's a doctor.
Don't go to Google.
What he says all the time is, yeah. Of course your Google search is the equivalent of 7 years of medical school.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
So whether it's any of the online medical things, if you put any symptoms into Google, mm-hmm. you will come up with a list of things. And if you're a hypochondriac, Google certainly is your best friend. But the problem is, I don't know how trustworthy, especially in the age not only of vaxxers, but let's use the phrase agnotology, mm-hmm. culturally constructed ignorance, whether it's global warming or vaccines or mm-hmm. work your way down the list of things that, mm-hmm. you know, 9/11 was an inside job and mm-hmm. it's just a run of insanity. That sort of stuff has found more and more fertile ground to grow in the internet era. There was some advantage to when there was only 3 broadcast stations because mm-hmm. that sort of junk never made it past the gatekeepers. So did a lot of positive things never made it past the gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. So now we have a fire hose, and it's becoming increasingly challenging for people to identify what is accurate and what is false.
Yeah, and what's interesting, in the face of those problems, though, Google still is the most trusted. I believe it's the most trusted entity in the world.
Really?
What if you were talking about a hospital? Right here, right now, all of a sudden, you get very worried about a health. What do you do first?
Immediately.
You call your doctor first or go to Google?
Immediately. Well, you do both because it takes 2 weeks to see the doctor unless you're bleeding out. And second, the next thing you do is look for hospitals with a specialty of whatever you suspect, 100%.
Well, not even looking for a hospital, but you start trying to self-diagnose and understand more about it. Mm-hmm. I do believe that Google has right now more authority than any entity likely in the history of mankind.
Wow, that's astonishing. I only have you for so many minutes left, so I wanted to get to my favorite questions. God, I have runs and runs of stuff that we're not going to get to. Before I forget, biggest winner of 2017, Netflix.
Netflix, operating system for joy in our lives. You look at, in sum, I think that the economy is bifurcated. There's only two sets of winners, and it's a small number of companies. What I refer to as Benjamin Button companies, the companies that age in reverse. When you turn on Waze and you use it, it gets better. The majority of products from the economic titans of yesterday, General Motors and Unilever, they aged. When I used a car, when I used toothpaste, it declined in value. The companies that are garnering the disproportionate spoils of our modern-day economy are Benjamin Button, the age in reverse. Every time you do a Google search, it gets 1/3 billionth better, the product. Every time you turn on Waze, it gets better for everybody
else.
Now
a Google company, right?
That's right. Facebook, every time you use it, the product gets better for everybody else. That's one set of winners. The other set of winners are the companies that help other companies reduce costs. Accenture, most successful services company in the world, is effectively helping big companies cut costs. Outsourcing companies, helping companies cut costs. So effectively, our economy, the winners are bifurcating into companies that age in reverse or companies that take care of the aged. You're either Benjamin Button or you're dying or you're caring for the sick. Those are the two companies that are working right now.
We began by referencing the four horsemen. Mm-hmm. It's always the next natural question is who's the fifth horseman?
So I went off on a tangent there with my whole Benjamin Button rant, but I effectively think Netflix does take information around your viewership. It's very simple, but it's very powerful. Last night I'm watching House of Cards season 4, episode 8, and Netflix is smart enough to go, if Scott likes season 4, episode 8, we think he's going to like season 4, episode 9, and they start auto-playing it. And it sounds basic, but it is the notion of an artificial intelligence figuring out what you want. And if you look at my home screen on Netflix, it has a bunch of stuff I want to watch. There are now more people, more millennials watch Netflix or have Netflix than have cable TV.
Wow.
So arguably Netflix should be worth more than all of cable TV if you think that millennials are the generation. They have the most disposable income. They're the ones that are going to go into their prime earning years.
Larger than boomers now?
I think they do. I think they do a fantastic job. The iOS is our mobile system for what I'll call the utility in our life. Amazon is our operating system for commerce. Facebook, I think, is a little bit our operating system for love and relationships. And I think Netflix is becoming our operating system for joy. I think it's got an opportunity to be a $200 or $300 billion market cap company.
And Amazon Video actually will immediately start playing the next episode until you tell it to stop. It'll just jack right into that. All right, so let's go into our favorite.
Oh, you didn't do biggest losers though. Biggest loser 17.
Okay.
Snapchat.
We said that earlier. Snapchat. You think the IPO is going to be mark the high price of Snapchat?
I think it'd be better for our economy if it did well, because we need a third player in the ecosystem outside of Google and Facebook. But I think Snapchat is going to get public, go crazy because of pent-up demand from retail investors who've been excluded from Uber and Airbnb. And then I think it's going to be sort of a slow-moving train wreck.
Here's who I have down for your losers theme from 2017. Traditional advertisers, we talked about them. Twitter, we talked about them. Yahoo, we talked about them. Here's one we didn't talk about, Pinterest.
Yeah.
Why is Pinterest a loser?
Fantastic product, not a great business. Immature management team that thinks it's in the business of art, not in the art of business. Again, another failure on the part of the board. And one of the things about venture capital is if you manage to get, you have an obligation to get the highest valuation possible. But the problem is when you raise money at, I think, a $12 or $13 billion market value.
A little rich.
Well, then you've got all these prefs. The company should have been bought for $5 billion, and everybody would have done really well. But now they've convinced people to invest at 12 or 13. There's effectively only three or four buyers of Pinterest. Of all the brands we track at L2, we don't know any actually buying advertising on Pinterest. So I think, again, this is a failure of a board. There's very few CEOs that can go from A to Z. I think they have a genius CEO in terms of product. He's not the guy to take it to the next level, and the board has failed to make the hard decisions around that. Management turnover there has been an absolute, the word I would want to use
debacle?
Is, debacle. Okay. I was going to use another term, but I was going to say cluster something, but
cluster debacle.
Cluster debacle. So yeah, I think it's a fantastic company. I think it's wildly overvalued. Twitter overvalued. Most overvalued company in the world right now.
Uh-huh.
WeWork, $17 billion.
We looked at a WeWork space, and it was fantastic.
I
was 40 years younger. And in the world of tech, these tiny little spots.
Great, great company, great concept, might even be worth $1 billion. But right now, if you look at WeWork, it's trading at $440,000 per customer.
A little high.
If you look at their valuation.
A little stiff.
If you take the majority of the WeWork buildings they're in, and you take the floor they've leased and put in a cool coffee bar, great marketing, great concept, great business model, and it is a great business and a great business model, but that floor is now worth more than the entire building
Makes
they're leasing
no sense.
That floor. So is it a great company? Yes. Is it a great idea? Yes. Is it worth 10 to 20%? Of what it's worth now, yes, most overvalued company in the world.
You know, it's the same thing as a Regis, or there's a handful of companies that do the office shares.
Yeah.
They just made it younger, hipper. There's a bar and a coffee lounge in the ground floor. The one on Bryant Park is funky and hip.
They do a fantastic – look, Twitter's an amazing company. I think it's worth $1 billion, $2 billion, which puts it at about 70% worth less than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
All of these companies are amazing. I'm not taking anything away from them. The problem is when you layer in their valuation, they make no sense.
So let's talk about a couple of other things on your loser list. Jet.com, recently purchased by Walmart, I think.
$3.5 billion hair plugs, trying to make Walmart going through a midlife crisis, trying to hang with the cool kids, not recognizing it's a mature company that should be slowing down its capex and and spending a ton of cash back to shares, says we have a culture problem. The most expensive acquihire in history, $3.5 billion, or about $6.5 million per employee, will be this biggest write down in the history of retail.
And what about Dollar Shave Club? You've said
another great company, Dollar Shave Club.
Was that $1 billion acquisition?
$1 billion. I think about $3.5 million per employee, losing money. Supposedly had discovered a new model for acquiring customers online. Gillette spent $50 million on TV advertising last year. Dollar Shave Club spent $55 million on TV advertising. The biggest winner in the Dollar Shave Club acquisition was Procter & Gamble, who had a competitor taken out of the marketplace on Unilever's balance sheet.
That's fantastic. All right, so let's get to my favorite questions before we run out of time. We've talked about your background, although I have to ask, you were at UCLA and Berkeley, right?
Yep. Public schools all the way through, just like you.
That's right. I went to SUNY Stony Brook. The joke was Berkeley, the Stony Brook of the West. But last week it was 20 degrees. Do you feel like you miss a little bit of California when New York weather gets like this?
Anybody who's from California, when you come into L.A. and you get in your car and you go to In-N-Out Burger, which is my pattern, you sort of wonder, what was I thinking ever leaving here?
But then you're there for a week and you're like, oh, now I remember.
I don't know. It's pretty nice out there.
It's fantastic out there. If
you and I are New York guys, though.
I'm born and bred.
Yeah,
born and bred. To me, California would be fantastic. Yeah. If you could follow the neutron bomb and start over.
My second.
I love California, but every time I'm there, I'm like, oh, now I remember why.
Second midlife crisis. I'm moving to LA, renting a Porsche, losing money in movies, and dying under suspect circumstances. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, off air, I'll tell you my favorite San Francisco story. That's like, oh, that's I love this place, but I consider myself, socially progressive, left of center. New York liberal, and I go out there, and I'm Attila the Hun.
They think
I am like Genghis Khan. They're just, oh, so you're really an extreme right winger. I'm like, no, you people are crazy. I'm pretty center left. You're just astonishing. And I repeat this over and over. I love California. I have family in La Jolla. We spend time out there. one of the most beautiful places. Yeah, Newport Beach, spectacular. Yeah. San Francisco is a world-class city.
Most beautiful city in America. It really is.
I can't imagine. And every time, you travel a lot.
Yep.
Every country I go to, every city I go to, I'm like, this place is fantastic. Like, we were in Copenhagen not too long ago. I'm like, wow, this is a great city.
Yep.
I'm not sure I could live here, but it's a fantastic city. Yep. San Francisco, every time I'm there, I'm like, I could live here. And then by the end of the trip, it's like, you know, I don't know. They would not put up with my New York shtick there for very long. I get away with it here. I can't get away with it there.
These are good problems. All great places.
All right. So let's talk. I'll do the abbreviated version of our favorite list. Early mentors. Who are some of the people that influenced the way you think about business and digital?
So probably my first business mentor was a guy named David Ocker, who inspired me in my second year of business school. And I decided that's what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. He's a professor, considered the father of modern management. I had some really nice kind of older brother, father figure like people who were mentors for me right out of business school. A guy named Pat Connolly, who just retired as CMO of Williams-Sonoma, has been a kind of a mentor for me as an adult person. As an adult, Warren Hellman invested in everything I did, the venture, the buyout guy out there. Some of my clients at Profit, a guy named Gord Schenk, who was the CMO of Levi's Canada, was very generous with me. There was just some nice, very nice, you know, decent people who took an interest in me and were very good to me. I feel very blessed that way. I was raised in a single parent household. My dad was around, but I didn't live with him. And, I was very fortunate at a very young age. A lot of, you know, older, mostly men took an interest in me professionally and were very generous with me. So I consider myself very fortunate around mentors. And anyone who doesn't have mentors, it's going to be tough to be successful because you need people on your shoulder who can give you advice even when they're not around because you get to know them and you get to kind of channel how they would handle a given situation.
So those are mentors. What about business people or other professionals who influence the way you approach business? You run one very successful business currently. Mm-hmm. A few of your prior businesses, Profit and Red Envelope, both were mm-hmm. very successful. Who were the big influences from a business perspective?
You know, so my dad gave me a bunch of Peter Drucker books when I was younger, mm-hmm. and I read those, and I tried, you know, that was sort of the basis, I think, for how I approach business, but I wouldn't say that like any one person or individual stands out. I don't model myself. You know, the only thing you get as you get older, you have a code, and I'm openly critical of a lot of managers. And every person I admire in history has one thing in common: they've given powerful people a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's okay to be critical of people as long as they're more powerful than me. So that gives me a very broad target set.
Punch up as opposed to punching down.
If you're being critical of people who have the same or less influence or power than you do, that's not being critical or starting a catalog.
You're bullying.
You're just bullying, 100%. Yeah. So the people I admire most in journalism and, you know, I wouldn't say in business, but have never been afraid to, as long as they're not being mean-spirited, call out other business people. But I wouldn't say I have, like, you know, there's so many incredible people you can look to now in business and you can learn so much about them. But I'm more about, you know, historical figures. I'm a big fan of Winston Churchill and, you know, folks like that. But I wouldn't say there's any kind of dominant. I'm not a religious person. I'm not. I don't have what I'd call a core set of people I look to for thoughtful advice.
So let me digress a bit because you just referenced something interesting. The CEO of Under Armour came out and said some positive things about President Trump. He's an asset to the business community. Their single biggest endorser, Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors, came out and said, well, he's right that he's an asset if you drop the ET. And then that got a little viral. And then the question became, they had the CEO of Under Armour and Curry had a conversation. And apparently all is well there.
Right.
What happens with the consumer society where we just saw what happened with Nordstrom dropping the Ivanka line? Is this going to be a litmus test amongst consumers and or their high-profile spokespeople?
So in the movie Broadcast News, William Hearst asks Albert Brooks, what do you do if your real life outpaces or is better than your dreams? And Albert Brooks turns to him and says, keep it to yourself. And that's so Kevin Plank, handled it poorly. I can almost guarantee you that when you're the CEO of a consumer company and you come out for or against
anybody, you're alienating half.
It's just, so I'm not faulting him for
a little less than half this time.
Yeah, but. I'm not faulting him for being positive. It would have been the same stupid move if he'd been critical of the president. Nordstrom handled it correctly. They basically said, look, her stuff's not selling. They even said, we like her. She's nice. We like her and her team. But the stuff's not selling. This is a business decision. In sum, political views from the CEO are best kept to yourself. And when Trump draws you in, I think you have a right or an obligation to respond in as thoughtful a way as possible. But actually, a lot of the CEOs have handled it really well. I think the CEO of Ford has handled it really well. I think Nordstrom handled it very well.
What about the Delete Uber campaign, which basically forced him, the CEO of Uber, off of Trump's business advisory board?
Yeah, consumers are getting very savvy around how quickly they can rally around an issue, and then they're smart to hit people in their pocketbook. That's when you really see action, right?
Boycotts used to be more or less meaningless. Every now and then one would have an effect. But between Facebook and others, Twitter and other social media, it seems that boycotts can be organized and put into place much more quickly and much more effectively than was true in the past.
Yeah, it's an exciting time from that end because you can rally people to a good cause. Travis being forced off of Trump's business advisory council was a, you know, pretty interesting thing. But the politicization, if you will, politicalization
of everything,
companies now has become really. You know, I love politics, and I'm exhausted by it all. It's every day. I just want to watch Modern Family every once in a while and not have politics be front. You know, I can't even watch MSNBC and Rachel Maddow. And I wonder if this is kind of officially another leg down of television, because I think TV and media and politics have literally just exhausted us and we're ready for about a 30-year break.
Except I just saw this headline the other day. For the first time, Colbert beats Jimmy Fallon. Fallon's considered a sort of nice guy, inoffensive. Has had Trump on. Colbert has been hammering Trump. So has who follows Fallon later
Seth,
at night?
Seth Meyers.
Seth Meyers.
They found their voice.
Yeah, and their voice has been to push back against the president. It's good for. It's not even good politics. It's good ratings.
Did you see SNL on Saturday night?
Oh, of course.
My God, the
opening is hilarious.
But it's not just the opening. I don't know if you saw the last one. It was literally the entire show.
The segment with Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah, as
Ian
Jeff
Jack
Sessions.
Tapers. With
Kelly Conway.
Yeah.
Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah. That was 6 minutes of. And you know the White House is watching
this. They're watching
this, seething, fuming.
Yeah, it's just so. I mean, it's just so. We're just totally in uncharted territory. And I have fantasies about this. I've done some activist investing. If Twitter goes below 10, I want to signal it now. I don't think I have to file a 13D here, but I'd like to buy somewhere between 1-2% of the company, form a group, renominate everyone but Jack Dorsey, and shut down the POTUS and the real Donald Trump account based on.
Really?
Well, I think he's violated their code of conduct.
Well,
I think
certainly,
when you
sure.
Harass people, hate speech. I think they have been inconsistent in their application of their standards around shutting some accounts.
I think they're afraid of POTUS. They won't do that.
I think we're all afraid, but I think we got to turn that thing off.
My hope for the election was when November 4th came and went, that's it, we're done, no more.
Right.
And if anything, it just became louder and one-sided.
But you're a markets guy, Barry. Markets have gone up. What do you think? What's gone on here? Why are the markets gone up?
Well, that's easy. The markets
devil, you know?
Yeah. Well, first, the narrative about what was going on, I think, misunderstood it. Markets are looking at $1 trillion infrastructure spends. That's stimulative. Big tax cuts may create deficits down the road. Nobody was a bigger deficit spender than Reagan. It was fantastic for the stock market. Mm-hmm. So you rejigger the corporate tax code. You repatriate $2 trillion of Apple and everybody else's
cash
that's overseas. It comes back. Mm-hmm. You're looking at, you know, this is the could be. Most people look at the markets as they time it from the bottom in March 2009 and say, look, the market's 7 years old. That's the wrong definition of a secular bull market. We broke out to the new highs in 2013, which means this market is 3 or 4 years old as a new bull market. Mm-hmm. And you've had a number of 20% resets. People tend to forget that. So if this market is 3 or 4 years old, hey, the last 20% correction, which we had January of last year, remember the whole conversation? Mm-hmm. People were saying as January goes, so goes the market. That was our 1987. We could be a dozen years left from 2000, and this could really run. Plus, you look at the rest of the world. If you want to invest cheaply, emerging markets are really cheaply. Mm-hmm. If you want to invest aggressively, you look at the worst place in the world, a combination of Japan and Europe, and you invest there. But the United States is expensive because we want the multiple that Apple and Google and Facebook do. Everything is as bad as people feel, as much as the middle class is getting squeezed, as much as the popularist uprising, call it Trump, call it Brexit, call it Le Pen in France. Overall, we're the ones who came through the financial debacle, which we essentially caused. We came through it the best. We ripped the Band-Aid off first. We didn't do what we should have, but we did something.
Mm-hmm.
We basically bailed out a bunch of banks. We propped up a bunch of financial system that was ready to collapse. I would have done it differently. I would have sent everybody to bankruptcy court if I was benevolent dictator, and you would have been much, it would have been more painful, but you'd be much healthier that much sooner. But here we are 7 years later. We have a functioning economy, essentially under 5% unemployment. So we're the, you know, we're the cleanest shirt in the hamper, so to speak. And so that's why the economy and the market continues to go higher. How are you interviewing me?
You're listening to Masters in Business with Scott Galloway. I'm here with my guest, Barry Ritholtz.
So let's go back to our questions. You mentioned Drucker. What are some of your favorite books? By the way, all you need to do is pull my string. That's it. I'm gone.
I enjoyed that.
I've watched you.
I was awake through most of that. That was pretty good.
Favorite books. What are some of your favorite books?
You send it every time. So there are a few things I'm embarrassed about because I like to think of myself as educated. I don't speak a second language.
Me neither.
And the reality is I read a ton. I don't read a lot of books. The
really?
Books that changed my life were the Peter Drucker books.
Which ones? Give me the titles.
What is it? The 20-Minute Man or The Modern Manager or... His early one about the Austrian economy, this is really obtuse that my dad sent me, but I forget the titles. And then influence on me is I'm kind of a war buff. I read, when I was in high school, I read all the Herman Wook books, War and Remembrance, The Winds of War.
Sure.
And I also just love John Irving books. I think he's just so strange.
John Irving?
Yeah, The World According
to Garp. World
According to Garp.
Slaughterhouse
Rules.
Did you like that movie?
Probably Robin Williams' best film.
Really?
Yeah.
I would challenge that. I'm going to have to come up with a list.
What would you like that's better?
Dead Poets Society.
Yeah. Good Morning
Good Will Hunting.
Good Will Hunting. Good Morning. Yeah, there's a bunch.
But he's a minor character in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
Dead Poets Society. He's a I would really have to.
Yeah,
and on the
talent.
Comedies, you know, some of his comedies were. Mrs. Doubtfire is a hilarious movie, and he's wonderful in
Another one he's pretty, I think it was called 24-Hour Photo. He's actually better at playing a psychopath than a comedian. Yeah, very
I haven't seen that. I heard good things about that.
So
Herman Wolk, Peter Drucker, and...
John Irving. Yeah, that's what I'm sticking with.
There's a scene in the reason I have an issue with Garp, there's a scene where he's in the driveway. We won't go into the details,
yeah.
But he's got the woman with him when he's rear-ended. I think that scene ruined the book for me. If
sort of,
you remember what I'm talking
about. Low budget gender transition.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It was before Tranny was
that's
a
that's a good scene.
It's horrific in the book.
Glenn Close plays his mother. She's outstanding in that as well.
There's some
she must have been excited to get a casting call to be Robin Williams' mother. It's like
right,
when Sally
she's 5
Field,
years younger than
when
her.
Sally Field was cast as Tom Hanks' mother in Forrest Gump, and I think she was 6 years older than him.
All right. Wasn't Robin Williams older than her?
I don't know. I don't remember.
It could have been that. All right. I know I only have a finite amount of time. Let's talk about what you do to keep mentally and physically fit outside of work. You mentioned you swim.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty into physical fitness. I try and do CrossFit 3 or 4 times a week.
How are your knees?
I've been really blessed with that stuff. I think physical fitness is a gift from God. It's my antidepressant. It keeps me sort of even keel, sort of. I struggle with anger. I get pissed off at stuff I shouldn't. But working out for me has just been a real like I said, just a gift from God. And I tell my kids in my class that if you are in good shape, you're going to make more money, you're going to be happier, you're going to have more sex, you're going to have more options in terms of who you mate with, you're going to feel more confident, you're going to be a better person to your friends, your pets, your neighbors, that it is absolutely one of the things you find that's consistent across the most successful people in business is not that they went to great schools, it's not that they're, you know, it's not that they're religious. The thing you find among almost all of them is they exercise every day.
So I'm going to do a really brief digression. The anger issue you referenced.
Yeah.
That's a hot ember, a hot coal that's in the core of your being.
Yep.
And you know how if you're ever working with a fire, you can blow on that and get that ember going again.
Yeah.
In all of your presentations, that's a very channeled, focused anger with all of the vitriol removed. It's, and I share that issue, but my wife says to me, where the hell does all this anger come from?
I think it's chemical.
I don't know what it is, but it's a fuel source that you can tap and redirect. And when I watch you take apart a particular segment, and again, I'm going to repeat for people, if you are not going on YouTube and seeing Galloway's videos on a weekly basis, as well as the DLD presentations,
which
you always make entertaining, and you're fearless to embarrass yourself. So you
do the
George Michael
go to what's easy.
and they're always entertaining, but they're filled with data, filled with information.
Thanks.
But I could see that there is a driving something that you want people to get to the correct answer. And it's frustrating that they're all looking in the wrong place and all coming to the wrong decision. So maybe anger and frustration are two sides of the same coin, but that's Pop Psychology for 100. That's what I see driving you, is getting people to the right place.
I think you're being generous. I just think I have some chemistry that's all screwed up.
Yeah.
And anchor off of negative. Given how fortunate I am, I don't think there's anything I can blame it on in my childhood. There's no one I can blame it on.
Single parent. That could be it.
I had a great mom, though, and I had a nice upbringing. And, you know, this isn't a sob story. We had a nice life.
Chemical is what your claim is.
You know, she and I got to take vacations, and we had a nice relationship, and I went to nice schools and I had nice friends, but I'm definitely going to be on something. I think as the side effects of the antidepressants lessen and my anger increases, those lines are going to cross and I'm ready. Bring it on.
Our last two questions.
Yeah.
So you work with a lot of students and millennials. What sort of advice do you give someone who says, I want to go into fill in the blank, technology, digital content?
I think about this a lot. A couple things. One, don't follow your passion. Most people who tell you to follow your passion, unfortunately, it's every speaker at lunchtime in Stern is already rich. Figure out what you're good at and then try and really expand. And being great at something will give you the currency and the economic reward and the psychological reward such that you'll start to love it. So your job as a young person is to figure out something you're good at, not your passions. I was meant to be quarterback of the Jets. I have a good plane of vision, a decent arm. I would have loved it, but I wasn't. I was mediocre at it as an athlete growing up. What I ended up being semi-great at was starting companies and analytics. Find out what you're good at. Get to a business that has recurring revenue. Recurring revenue companies are valued at a multiple of revenues versus a multiple of EBITDA. You want to be in a recurring revenue company. You want to be, in my opinion, getting more tactical. The two technologies in the next 3 to 5 years are voice and messaging. I'd want to find companies in the ecosystem of voice and messaging. Get to a city. Two-thirds of the economic development is going to be within a bike ride of a major world-class engineering university. Make sure you live near one of those and get into that ecosystem.
You pointed out that most of the major successful companies in the S&P 500 are all right near a major university, a renowned university.
How can you tell if a kid's successful? How long does it take him or her to get to the biggest city in their country? And then how long does it take them to get to London in Europe, Shanghai, Beijing, or Hong Kong, or Singapore in Asia, or San Francisco, New York in the U.S.? Our most talented human capital is flocking to these barter town, full body contact business centers. And your ability to get the skill set, the competitive nature, the grit, and the opportunities is very geographically sensitive.
The intellectual capital is there. And our final question, what is it that you know about technology, digital brands, marketing, startups today that you wish you knew 20 plus years ago when you began?
It sounds very past saying it's not that romantic, but one of my venture capitalists, Larry Bond, says success is in the agency of others. Trying to find good people and then overcompensate, show empathy for them, really trying to figure out what it is they want and make your successes there such that they're loyal to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was a little bit more Darwinian as a younger person. And also just get to a business with recurring revenue. I know that sounds ridiculous, but
no, it works.
The business of software is just a better business. The business of owning a gym versus private training is a bet. Being the insurance company that gets the bills everybody every year as opposed to the doctor, the healthcare provider, recurring revenue, I think, is where it's at. And get towards something that is 1 or 2 degrees separated from the plummeting price and processing power or something around technology. Technology is eating the world.
We have been speaking with Professor Scott Galloway of NYU Stern School of Business. If you want to learn more, go to his YouTube channel. Just search for Scott Galloway at L2. Or we didn't talk about your book. You have a book coming out in September. We'll revisit that when that book comes out. Thanks, Winners and Losers.
Yep, Winners and Losers.
Who's publishing that?
Portfolio Penguin Random House.
Not self-published. You should be self-publishing.
Just barely.
If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look Up an Inch, Down an Inch on Apple iTunes. You could see any of the other 130 such conversations. I would be remiss if I did not thank my booker, Taylor Riggs, my recording engineer, Medina, or Michael Batnick, my head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Masters in Business is brought to you by Proper Cloth, the leader in men's custom shirts. With proprietary smart size technology and top-rated customer service, ordering a custom shirt has never been easier. Visit propercloth.com to order your first custom shirt today.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.